Rock, 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 tight, 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 sis, 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 boom, 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 ah! Princeton, Princeton, Princeton!
The Princeton Locomotive Cheer. It's part of a playful day of ceremony and initiation for new students arriving at Princeton University. I'm Rob Broomby, and in this, the first of two BBC World Service programmes, I'll be looking at the brash world of university fundraising. The welcome ceremony here marks the start of a lifelong relationship with an elite college. When students leave, they'll be expected to support the institution financially for decades, voluntarily. It's a mindset that has made Princeton one of America's wealthiest universities. With governments in many developed countries trying to save money, colleges are keen to learn how to raise cash the North American way. And Princeton is the gleaming example. It's a private-funded university, and raising cash from philanthropists and wealthy former students is in its DNA. But as universities worldwide are finding out, with big money come big risks.
The trouble with tainted money is that taint enough of it.
Do people try to buy influence, do you think?
Sure. I mean,
that's... Do they succeed?
Sure.
And where private money flows in, universities and colleges can be left surfing on controversy.
There is a right way to go about these kinds of partnerships, and there's a wrong way. There's no doubt we made the right decision.
When it comes to fundraising, Princeton University, an hour and a half from New York, is the market leader. I've come to find out how this remarkable institution, with just 7,500 students, 5,000 of those being undergraduates, accumulated the largest endowment per student of any university in the US, a staggering $17 billion, money it spends on buildings, facilities, research, and scholarships to keep Princeton at the top of the university's Premier League. They've turned raising cash into an art form. At the welcoming ceremony, an eclectic mix of modern and traditional, the message is clear. You are the elite. You've been chosen. Make the most of it.
You have now become one of the 1%. Not in terms of wealth, but certainly in terms of future opportunity. And I hope you will leave our campus saying, as generations of students have said before you, this place changed my life. Welcome to Princeton.
Jim Robertson is from the class of 1991. He says for most graduates, giving back to the university starts modestly with a gift of around $20.
I guess it's so institutionalized at this point that each class as a graduate just falls into this structure that already exists. Somebody from the senior class is the elected class agent while they're here. And so that person's job is to run fundraising for the next 5 years. People that give very modestly for 20 years, 25 years, 50 years, suddenly a rather large gift comes from them just because they sold a business or whatever the case may be, that long-term engagement ends up resulting in something very financially tangible for the university.
Annual reunions are attended by thousands. There are dinners, speeches, fireworks, parades. Jim Floyd from the class of 69 comes back for the razzmatazz. But for the university, there's big money in it.
What the University Development Office and the university tradition now overlays on it are a number of different competitions. Which class can give the most money on their 25th reunion, or their 50th reunion, or their 10th reunion, and they are publicly recognized for doing that. There are classes that can hit their 25th reunion and literally provide millions of dollars just from one class.
This is the Woodrow Wilson School, a clean, white, stone-clad, modern building designed by the same architect as the old World Trade Center. Though it's not high-rise, it shares many of the same design features. It's named after the former president of Princeton, Woodrow Wilson, who went on to be the U.S. president. They like to joke here that that was something of a demotion. Well, I've come to speak to Professor Stan Katz, a leading expert on university funding.
All American universities take alumni very seriously.
When it comes to admissions, he says, the sons and daughters of alumni, former students, do have an advantage.
Well, it means that there's at least, perhaps not a thumb, but a little finger on the scale when you make that final decision. It's a plus in the formula they use to decide on admissions. And it means, in some sense, that two equally qualified candidates, the child or grandchild of an alumnus or an alumna, will get an edge.
But the reason for you doing that is what?
Well, there is a bloody-minded reason, that is to say, to encourage wealthy alumni to continue to be generous to us. I think it's also, though, this sort of community reason. We really do care that there's a group of people who care desperately about the welfare of the institutions, not just money. And a huge effort is put in to foster alumni loyalty.
Put simply, the alumni are more likely to give generously if their children stand a better chance of getting into the club. Princeton told us one in every seven undergraduates is a child of alumni. With the freshman day formalities over, there's the obligatory Princeton sing-along on the steps underneath a beautiful Gothic arch. It's tradition, but it's also about manufacturing community. In the crowd of doting parents, I bump into two fathers, friends since their days at Princeton.
Class of 1980.
We met freshman week.
And then we became roommates after that, and we have been friends ever since.
And not only that, but your daughters are both here today starting their university education.
That's right. They're both in classes in 2016.
So here we are, having had the joy of being Princetonians all of our lives, and then something which is almost impossible, getting into the school, and it turns out that both of our daughters got in, and they both got into the same class, so the next generation carries forth the great traditions of Princeton.
Eric and I both were following in our father's footsteps.
My father was class of
47, and Eric's father was class of 55.
Whilst they're doing this, tell me where your daughter is.
My daughter is on the sixth row, back up there among the about 1,400 people who were before us. When they were little girls, they used to chase newts together in Vermont, and now they're actually in the same class, carrying on the traditions of Princeton.
You must be very proud, both of you.
Proud and excited, and so happy to be able to be here to be part of it. The fact that we're parents helps a tiny bit, but they did it on their own.
The college has found a formula to turn student loyalty into donations. So the American way appears to work, here at least. And there are definite advantages to attending a college awash with cash. Board and tuition costs a whopping $55,000 a year, but well over half receive some form of assistance. The average grant is $37,000. In the shade of the centuries-old trees, I met students Lisa, Mike and Adam.
Within the first 2 months, they had sent me for free to Six Flags, which is an amusement park, Bermuda, and to New York to see a Broadway show. So they sort of wowed me with just the money that they lavished on us.
I would say that about half of my education is paid for by Princeton, and that's largely through alumni donations.
That's quite a contribution, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely... I would not be here. I would be at a different school if they didn't do that.
Mike, I think you got some support as well here.
Yeah. My grant is actually from one of the early classes in the 1800s, so there's nobody to thank, but they're fully funding my entire education here.
So will you graduate with no debts whatsoever? Is everything paid for?
Yeah, I'm going to be graduating debt-free this year.
So, as they approach the end of their studies, are they feeling pressure to become donors themselves?
I guess a little bit, at least in a token gift early on, right out of school, will be something that I'll definitely want to be doing, and I know there's going to be a lot of pressure on us to do at the end of this year when we graduate. And then longer term, I think if you are successful, I'd like to try and give something back. I think Princeton's given me a large gift, and I'd like to try and repay that for a future student who's going to be in a very similar spot as me.
And yet, if you're all lucky enough to enjoy lucrative careers and make a bit of money in your time, and you want to do good work with that money, there are a thousand things out there other than the university you could consider, like funding a charity. Why would one give to Princeton?
No matter what other things I get interested in, I will always be a Princetonian. I'll be coming back every year for reunions that I can physically travel here. And so I think it's just so much a part of my identity that no matter what other charities I'm also supporting, at least a little bit has to come here for me.
Once a Princetonian, always a Princetonian. Every building appears to have been constructed here with donor money. It's a rich college getting richer from alumni and other donors wanting to be associated with the Princeton brand. Mike, one of the students I've just met, agrees to show me round.
So this building is East Pine.
Did this one come about as a result of donation?
It did. So East Pine was the donation of Mrs. Pine. So the Pine family donated a number of buildings. So this is Firestone Library, a donation by the Firestone family. Three generations of Firestones were Princeton alumni and donated the pride of the Princeton Library system.
And that's Firestone Tires to you and I?
Firestone Tires, yes. So on the west side of campus, one of the most well-known buildings is the Frick Chemical Laboratories, named after Henry Clay Frick of the Coke fortunes in Pittsburgh. And this one is the Woolworth Center for Musical Studies, donated by the Woolworth family of department store fame and fortune. In a certain way, it really stands as the last testament to the Woolworths, since all the stores are now out of business.
Yeah, lost from the high street, but their name is forever interned here.
Yes, yes.
In fact, almost nothing we see or stand on is not donated.
Yeah, it's true.
No shortage of donors.
No, never.
Princeton graduates tend to become high earners who can give back. Less prestigious colleges will never be able to raise money on the same scale. That won't stop them trying, but if Princeton-style fundraising became the norm globally, are there implications for academic freedom? That question took me back to the offices of Professor Stan Katz.
Sure, there is. I mean, the famous phrase here is, the trouble with tainted money is that taint enough of it.
Do people try to buy influence, do you think?
Sure. Sure, I mean...
Do they succeed?
Sure. They succeed in moving universities in directions that they're not unwilling to move, but they might not have moved in that direction quite so readily.
One of the things we've seen in Britain is the proliferation of business schools. Everyone wants to finance a business school, ideally with their name on it. The expense, perhaps, of more traditional subjects which are being squeezed out.
Well, this is a huge problem, and this is happening, well, I think everywhere in the Western world, but it's certainly happening here. Universities see their opportunities to raise very large sums of money in order to do certain kinds of things. Those kinds of things these days are intensely practical, mainly scientific, and so the threat is that we will respond to those and we will skew the traditional orientation of the university to the full range of liberal subjects. Will the humanities get left behind? I think this is a major issue for all European and American universities.
Well, I suppose the question is, will they?
I think so.
Stan Katz is at Princeton, but he's talking about universities in general. We wanted to ask the college about the issues he raised. They declined to give us an interview. But do donors ever go further and try to interfere in the work of the departments they fund? I'm heading north across the border to find out.
This is York University on the anonymous margins of Toronto, Canada. It's a modern sprawling campus which nestles alongside oil and gas installations, an academic haven from the urban landscape of parking lots and freeways. This campus, though, was the unlikely setting for a row which pitched professors against wealthy benefactors. At issue, a gift worth tens of millions of dollars. Good news? Well, that's not what many academics here thought.
The initial reaction was, what a great opportunity. Here we had a private donor willing to put up $30 million, which was going to be matched by $30 million from the provincial government, to create a world-leading center on international law in the global economy.
Professor Stepan Wood says his hopes soon turned to fears. The money targeted for the Osgoode Hall Law School, part of York University, was coming from a think tank called CIGI, the Centre for International Government Innovation, funded by Jim Balsillie, the man behind the BlackBerry mobile devices.
10 new chairs, and these would be recruited from among leading academics in these fields from around the world.
It sounds fantastic. What was the problem?
Well, the problem was that the agreement gave unprecedented role to the external donor in the hiring, renewal and firing of faculty, the setting of research agendas, and in the various aspects of academic programming that would be undertaken as part of the initiative within the law school.
Professor David Dewitt of the think tank CIGI that's tried to make the donation rejects that interpretation. He says they never wanted to veto appointments.
Our role was there to ensure that the four fields that the money was designated by the two donors was respected, and that we were there to help identify, as best as possible, the outstanding candidates of people who could come in and serve as faculty, but that ultimately the decision about who would be appointed would be a York University decision.
The top and bottom of it was, though, you didn't get to a point where the academics was satisfied that you were just donors and you would be keeping this at arm's length without interference. They had real concerns which weren't in the end satisfied.
I'm not sure, given what I understand of those who weren't satisfied, if there was anything that we could have done to satisfy them. I know that within 3 to 4 days of York University announcing that they were withdrawing, we at CIGI received expressions of interest from deans and presidents of other universities and law schools in Ontario saying they had looked at our documents and with minor tweaking, they were eager to enter into negotiations with us.
But you think it was ideological, the opposition to the money?
I think that was an aspect of it.
The bitter wrangling lasted months and saw the law faculty at odds with the university management, keen to take the money. Eventually, under faculty pressure, the gift was rejected. Professor Wood was relieved.
Oh, I think there's no doubt we made the right decision. I actually think it set a strong precedent and sent a clear message to benefactors and universities around Canada that there is a right way to go about these kinds of partnerships and there's a wrong way, and the conditions under which we can go forward are pretty clear.
Well, walking around York University, this doesn't look like an organization which is in any way opposed to raising money. In fact, they appear to be rather good at it. Just taking one building at random, this is the Shulrich School of Business, the name paid for by the well-known Canadian businessman Seymour Shulrich. Well, let's see what else we can find in here. Well, coming down the corridors, there's the Lawrence Bloomberg wing, and that's close to the National Bank Financial Lecture Hall. Down another corridor, and we find the RBC Capital Markets wing, the Procter & Gamble classroom, and the Invesco Trimark Lecture Hall. The signs at the entrance to this place read more like a stock market listing page than an academic institution.
I'm from BBC Radio.
Oh, hi.
We're intrigued. Every single room in this organisation seems to have a sponsor's name on it.
I'm very happy.
It doesn't matter to me at all.
They're actually key sponsors that they come in and network with us.
So it's not compromising at all?
No, not compromising at all. Because, like, what else are you going to name a room, right? Like, W133? Like, it's good to have, like, a name to a room, you know? There's no harm in it.
That's capitalism, I guess, so I love it.
European students might be surprised by those opinions, but they'll have to get used to this new way of doing things. The lesson from York is that the core principle of academic freedom is likely to be increasingly challenged as private money floods in.
Back at Princeton University, yet another building is going up. But Professor Stan Katz has a warning for those who see philanthropy and sponsorship as wholly innocent.
The broader concern that I really do have is whether or not we're not building a Frankenstein's monster. The underlying problem, I would say, by the way, is that we have built institutions that are so rapidly growing, so large and so needy, that we can't keep feeding the monster. That's the sense in which it is a Frankenstein's monster.
Needy of cash.
Needy of cash. Yeah, needy of resources. My advice would be to be very careful what you hope for, because it may bite you. We're building the university, and you are too, on a market model. And increasingly, that's the criterion. My own critique would be that we can afford to stick to our traditional values, and I don't think we are.
Universities around the world have much to learn from colleges like Princeton, both the enormous benefits and the risks too. Risks that, if not well managed, can destroy reputations. Last year's Libyan uprising was brutal, but there was another organisation caught in the crossfire, thousands of miles away.
This is the London School of Economics, one of Britain's finest academic institutions. Before the uprising, the LSE had developed strong links with Colonel Gaddafi's Libya, especially with the dictator's son. Saif Gaddafi was allowed to study here for a PhD, for which he was ill-prepared. He received special assistance, which led to doubts that his thesis was all his own work. Hardly was the ink dry on his PhD certificate when the LSE accepted a huge financial gift from his foundation. $2.5 million, no less.
Can I have a latte, please?
Yes,
sir. Do you have to have here?
The gossip here at the LSE coffee bar was bitter. Staff and students felt their college's reputation had been jeopardised. When the scandal broke, the director, Sir Howard Davis, was forced to resign. What had begun innocently enough with a search for cash the American way had led LSE into a calamity. Lord Wolfe wrote an official report on what went wrong.
At that time, Gaddafi was being very friendly towards the West, giving every indication of being somebody who it was worth supporting. This was an awakening call to LSE. I think the dangers should have been managed, and they weren't. Every university could do with more money than is available. And so every university is anxious to obtain donations, but they are well advised to be very cautious.
In this case, it does look like LSE had to grow up very quickly.
That is right. And what happened to LSE when it was publicised meant the other universities had to grow up very quickly. The report, I think, came as a surprise and a shock to many people.
The LSE was badly wounded. In their drive to copy an American fundraising model, they'd plunged off the road. Next week, we focus on Europe and hear from those trying to bring in bold American fundraising techniques with some controversial results. That's part two of Influence by Degree, produced by David Edmonds with me, Rob Broomby.